You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, look at the environmental and ecological damage caused by the tsunami that hit Southeast Asia. People in the area are having enough trouble getting their lives back in order, or at least trying to do whatever they can in that tremendous tragedy that's going on over there. And now they're facing additional challenges from the environment. The lives of many people in many of the areas hit by the tsunami are intricately linked. They're intricately tied to the natural world. For example, in Sri Lanka, an island hard hit by the water, many people make their living by fishing or from the ecotourists that come to trek the tropical jungles or soak up the sun on the island beaches. And there are reports that the coral reefs around Thailand have been hard hit by the waves and the debris. And as you know, coral reefs are diverse and very fragile ecosystems. They're sort of the gardens of the oceans. They're home to fish and invertebrates. The Indian Ocean also is also home to mangroves, whose long finger-like roots protect fish and anchor the soil from the waves. So you have these ecosystems that were already under stress from people living there, from ecotourism, from fishing. Now you have this tsunami that's come along, and it could it be the nail in the coffin to many of these ecosystems? That's what we're going to be talking about this hour. And what about the animals in the areas hit by the water? You know, we hear all these reports that following the earthquake, many animals headed inland before the waves hit. We haven't seen the carcasses of dead animals. Did they actually sense something? Did they have a way of maybe feeling the ground or the earthquake rumbling that sort of mimics things that happen in their own lives that tell them when danger is coming? They head for the hills or something? That's where we're going to talk about also. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Don Melnick is the Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation at Columbia University. He's also Thomas Hunt Morgan Professor of Conservation Biology there. He joins us here in our New York City studio. Thanks for coming in today, Dr. Melnick. Ellen Pickich is the Executive Director of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science. She's also a professor at the University of Miami. She joins us by phone from her office in New York. Thanks for being with us today. We've lost Dr. Pickett. We'll get her back. Also, Eric Falt is the Director of the Division of Communications and Public Information in the United Nations Environmental Program. He joins us by phone from Nairobi, Kenya. We're going to get him on the phone and see if we can get the phone lines working well today. We're having trouble with them, as you can tell. But let me have Dr. Melnick, thank you for being with us here today.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us what you can about the environmental impact of what's going on over there in the tsunami area.
Right. I think one of the things that we should realize is this is not the first time a tsunami has hit. The last big tsunami to hit was in 1883, about 120 years ago, and it had an impact on many of the same areas, particularly in southern Sri Lanka, the areas you've heard about like Hambantota and Galle and all. The big difference has been this time the human toll. Very few people were killed in the tsunami, at least from historical records that we have mm-hmm. in those areas when it hit 120 years ago. There's been an enormous loss of life, obviously, this time. Just to put that in perspective for a second, imagine that the province of Aceh has 4 million people in it, roughly half the amount of people in New York City, and it's probably when the death toll is fully accounted, it will be 110,000. So imagine being in New York City and having lost 220,000 people in one day. It's an enormous impact. So
wow.
We really should understand the tragedy of that. It's interesting, when the tsunami first hit, I began immediately emailing all of my colleagues. I've worked in that region of the world, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, for over 25 years. I began emailing them to find out whether they were all right. Of course, they responded, and I'm really glad that every single one of them was all right, as well as their families. But they responded with information about the wildlife, because that's what we do. And I've worked in, you probably have read about Yala National Park in the southeastern part of mm-hmm. Sri Lanka. Much to my amazement, they told me that numerous anecdotal stories that they heard from the people when they were driving through and asking them, most of the large mammals, the elephants, deer, many of the other large animals, began moving inland several minutes before the tsunami hit.
But after the earthquake,
After the earthquake, before the waves hit. And they were quite surprised by that. And then, of course, the waves came in. And it's not clear whether they were able to pick up changes in air current because the seas were rolling as fast as they were rolling. These tsunamis were moving at 100 right. miles an hour or more. Or whether they had picked up the trembles from the earthquake, which is pretty far away from there. But clearly they were reacting and clearly they were moving. Of course, the birds could fly in. Inland, and you didn't have to go in too much. So you have to realize that within just going in 1 kilometer meant right. all the difference in the world, and that's, what, 12 city blocks. And that was the difference between washed into the sea and surviving.
But they could pick it up earlier, and they can run faster.
Well, both of those yeah. are true. Yeah. How they picked it up, nobody right. really knows. And there have been many stories about how animals have been able to detect earthquakes and other kinds of natural disasters, and exactly how that's done is not clear. But it story after story indicates that that is the case. The same was not true, unfortunately, for the people in that area.
Yeah. Ellen Pickett, the Indian Ocean has many, many coral reefs, some of them very shallow. Can you tell us how some of the reefs are, what they're like, and what the tsunami has done to some of them?
Well, sure. You know, we're just really starting to get the reports in now. But the Indian Ocean is known for being one of the most diverse marine ecosystems in the world. So, as you said, coral reef ecosystems are already known to be sort of the rainforests of the sea, highly diverse. In the Indian Ocean, the areas that were hit are amongst the most diverse of those. We are dealing with an environment that has been pretty traumatized by other factors, like overfishing, pollution, disease, blast fishing. And so what we're seeing here is a major insult being added to an already traumatized system.
Mm-hmm. And what have we actually seen the devastated coral reefs?
Well, what's been the clearest thing that we've seen are pieces of coral, you know, huge chunks of coral being thrown up on shore, and that's been reported in many different areas. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of debris that's been going into the ocean from the land that's been carried in through the wave action. And we've gotten one report from a scientist who's part of our Pew Fellows program in Indonesia. And his real major concern is that that debris is going to be acting like a major wrecking ball under the ocean.
So you could have like cars and trees and heavy big things that were dragged back with the receding water.
Exactly.
And now the waves are just pounding it mm-hmm. into a pulp using those things like battering rams.
Exactly.
And this is quite common, I imagine, wherever the waves have been.
Well, I mean, this is a really, really widespread event, as you know, mm. and we haven't seen anything like this in over 40 years. And, you know, again, the ocean has changed a great deal in those 40 years. Mm. We've lost 90% of the top ocean predators. The mangrove habitat that would have formerly served as a buffer along the shorelines, more than half of that is gone from areas like India, Thailand, the Philippines. So we have a much less buffered system.
And the mangroves are also homes for sea creatures.
Mangroves, right, are amongst the most important marine habitats for sea life. They serve as nursery areas for fishes. And, you know, without mangroves, we really would have much less fish in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. So here you have, as you say, a place that's already under stress, and now this is stressing the recovery ability even further.
Exactly, yeah.
Eric Fault, what is the UN program going to look at first? Which problems, you have to, I guess, prioritize things. Which are the most important things to look at?
Well, we're going to look at a host of problems, and clearly at this stage all we can say is that there is, as already been underlined, massive circumstantial evidence that the natural environment has been seriously affected. And now we're going to look scientifically, involving as many people and groups as possible, to see exactly how the environment has been affected. There's a number of issues that we need to consider. First, maybe I should underline that we have not brought up the issue of the environment too early in the crisis, because clearly it is the suffering of the people mm-hmm. and their urgent need for food and shelter and medicine that was important. But the second phase of the recovery is starting, and we must look at the natural habitat that has been upset by this tsunami. We're going to look first at seawater contamination of underground and surface sources, because it does present an immediate threat to the population. Right now, there's a lot of wells and irrigation systems. There's also fish ponds, vegetable gardens that have been heavily salinated. This is having an impact in terms on the local agriculture, on the farmers, and we need to see how this has been impacted. We can do that using remote sensing, satellite imagery. Luckily, this is an area that was very carefully mapped out before. Now we need to look at what has happened in these areas and try to help the government concerned in the recovery phase. That's one area. I think the issue of waste and debris is a very, very important one. There's mud and sand covering many of the affected areas, and we need to remove the massive amount of waste and debris, because that too is crucial to prevent further environmental pollution and, of course, risk to human health. One area that has not been talked about yet very much in the media is probably the possible pollution from industrial sites. We know that all along the coastline concerns, and this is, we're talking about 12 countries in total, of course, there's a number of chemical storage sites, there are electrical facilities, oil refineries and ports. So our job will be to try to get in touch with the industries concerned, see if they're willing to share some of the information with us, and examine exactly what kind of environmental risks may have occurred in the process. Hmm. There are, of course, many other issues that need to be looked at when you talk about the environment. We try to also consider them in the context of the impact on the economic activities and the livelihoods of the communities affected. I think Ellen was just talking about the fish stocks, for instance, which may have been affected by the tsunami. This is quite important, because it will, or it can, have an impact on the livelihood of the population concerned. And obviously the ecosystems such as the mangroves and the coral reefs are also crucial. Luckily, there are many, many individuals, scientists who know and have gathered a lot of data about the area. The mangroves and the coral reefs have been studied in the Indian Ocean for many years now, so we'll be able to hopefully have, thanks to the solidarity that we expect from the scientific community, to have a good idea of what mm-hmm. has happened to these ecosystems.
I'm reading from your release here, but it says that the UN has mobilized $1 million to respond to these needs. Doesn't sound like a lot of money to me on this.
No, obviously. No, this is very little, but that's what we had to make available for immediate environmental activities, for sending people into the field to work with our UN colleagues in the immediate aftermath of the
tsunami. We can expect more money coming then, following up on that.
We're certainly hoping that more money will come in. The flash appeal that has been issued by the Secretary General in Jakarta yesterday had a number of environmental elements. They're clearly not the most important, but the environment is present, and we know it is important to be there at the start. Otherwise, the environment is simply forgotten. We've seen that in too many crises, and we were very keen to make sure that we could identify some basic needs. We're working closely with the governments of Indonesia, the Maldives, and Sri Lanka in particular, but also Thailand, to identify early needs and try to help them mobilize some funds. So that some of the assistance needed can be funded properly. But obviously much more is needed.
Let me just jump in and say, remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did you want to jump in there?
I wanted to jump in, Ellen, and just emphasize, you know, the impact on the livelihoods that could occur as a result of the loss of the fisheries. I mean, this is not just a loss of economic activity, but many of the people in this region depend heavily on fish as food. And in fact, in some areas, as much as 90 to 100% of the protein is coming from fish. So this is going to have an impact, or could potentially have an impact in the very near term, on the wellness of people in the area.
Don?
I would like to make two comments. One, to reiterate what Eric was saying, and that is my colleagues tell me in Sri Lanka that the thing they are most concerned about right now is the saltwater intrusion into lakes and streams within Yala National Park and the other national parks along the coast, which are sanctuaries for land animals. And it's particularly crucial within Sri Lanka because Sri Lanka is a highly seasonal environment. There are long dry periods where the animals are highly dependent upon those watering holes. And if they are more or less contaminated with salt water, this is going to be a very big problem for them to get sufficient amount of water for them to survive those dry periods. There's another major potential impact here, and this is in Aceh in northern Sumatra, and that is we now have about 1 million people at least that are displaced, that is, their homes were completely destroyed. If you've seen the photos, you know we are talking about completely destroyed. Those homes have to be rebuilt, and one of the big concerns is that right up back behind it in the highlands is one of the most diverse forest ecosystems in all of Southeast Asia. It's an area that there's been a lot of tension about what to do and whether to log it. Now there's going to be tremendous pressure on that forest to be logged to provide building materials. So unless an alternative source for building materials can be brought in order to rebuild that area, and it is an enormous area and many, many dwellings that have to be rebuilt, this could potentially spell the end or at least a very serious damage to the upland forests of Aceh.
But it would be possible to bring in the wood from outside if you thought enough about it and planned it ahead in advance.
That's right. There are plantations. There are other sources of building materials that could be brought in. But if there's a great rush to actually get the closest materials you have to build, this will place a really unprecedented pressure on those forests.
What about one other? I had seen reports that the Maldives at one point were totally submerged, like under 5 feet of water. They disappeared. What does that do to the land and to the things that are growing and living there?
Well, it's interesting because this question has come up. Now, you should realize that many of these small islands generally don't have large vertebrates, large right. mammals. They have a lot of small, and most of them don't have really unique species, that is. So I don't think we really are too worried that a species was completely lost in the tsunamis. But but clearly there were populations that were completely washed away. They likely will be recolonized. These are archipelagos of islands and birds and plants. And
are the plants dead too?
Well, the plants will be gone. Many of them will be gone, not all of them, but birds will be flying over. They will be dropping the seeds. They do a lot of seed dispersal, right. Birds do, and they drop it with fertilizer, and so they will take hold. And that's how plants are dispersed. I think one way we can look at recovery, or one little laboratory for recovery, is to go to Krakatoa, which blew 120 years ago, and go to that island. You'll see there are animals, there are plants, things are beginning to recover. That's what's going to happen to some of these islands that are out, you know, farther away from the coast.
Mm-hmm. But Don, as you know, the state of recovery is rather slow.
Very slow.
As we saw earlier this year.
Yeah.
All right. Let me hold that thought, because we'll talk about recovery and watching it. After this break, we have to go away. We'll be right back talking lots more about the environmental effects of the tsunami. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, advancing policy solutions to promote retirement security for all Americans, on the web at pewtrusts.org. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the opening of the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, MOMA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Pentagon is confronting an enemy within its own ranks, sexual assault against women in the military. Solving that problem and changing the culture calls for a new, tough set of standards.
We must be consistent and uniform in the way we do this, and that starts with the very definition of what is sexual assault.
The Pentagon's new policies on sexual assault, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the ecological and environmental impact of the tsunamis and the recovery that we might look forward to. My guest, Don Melnick, Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation at Columbia University. Ellen Pickich is the Executive Director of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science. Eric Falt is the Director of the Division of Communications and Public Information for the UN Environmental Program, on the line from Nairobi. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Ellen, I rudely interrupted you. You were about to talk about recovery?
Well, yeah, I think that we're going to see varying levels of recovery depending on what part of the world you're talking about. The things I worry about the most are species that have limited distribution, live pretty close to the coastline, and were already pretty endangered prior to this event. So I'm thinking of things like sea turtles. Hmm. Many sea turtles are extremely endangered, and we would expect that some of their nesting beaches have been completely devastated as a result of the tsunami. Now, sea turtles do spend a lot of time out at sea, so they could come back, and as long as there's the ability to have some habitat out there where they could rebuild their nests, then they should be able to recover over time. But some populations are so depleted that this may be the last straw for them.
Hmm. Don?
Yeah, I agree with Ellen. The sea turtles, I think, are probably the animals that are going to have perhaps the greatest impact. And we heard today that a number of sea turtle recovery programs in Sri Lanka were washed away, and tens of thousands of eggs in these hatcheries were washed away with them. So that is a real concern. Serendipitously, we have an opportunity to really study recovery, and I've been in email contact with my colleagues in Sri Lanka, and we are going to try to launch a study of the recovery of certain areas within Yala National Park in Sri Lanka to really look to see what initially what the impacts have been, and then slowly over time see what the trajectory of recovery is, and then look at it with respect to different kinds of animals, you know, in terms of the large mammals, which I don't think had any really significant impact, but I think a lot of the small vertebrates had impact. Certainly sea turtles and certainly habitat areas were damaged. And it I think will be very interesting to us to see, even though we didn't plan this, to see what the actual recovery trajectory is.
Now, from Australia, I've heard reports of concern about dugongs throughout the area, actually.
Tell people what those are.
Okay, well, dugongs are related to manatees, which is the closest relative that we have in the United States. They're also called sea cows. They look a lot like cows, but they hang vertically in the water. And they have very limited mobility, and again, many of them are very endangered. Now, some of them, because they have limited mobility and they are close to shore, the wave could have beached vast numbers of them. We're not hearing reports of that, great reports of large numbers being beached. But even small numbers can be important when you have a very endangered species. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting is the potential for later-term mortality, because these animals feed on seagrasses, and there's a high likelihood that the seagrass beds on which they fed could have been ripped out from close to shore. And that could cause these animals to starve over a period of the next several months.
Hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Kathleen in Athens, Ohio. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know if this applies to what they're talking about, but, you know, we all know this is 2005, and the ability to communicate via television, radio, emails, and cell phones is enormous, and Indonesia's wired. And I keep hearing excuses as to why all means to communicate were not activated. And one of the excuses is that many of the countries involved did not have evacuation plans. My question is, why weren't all means completely exhausted to alert people along the coastlines? And Ira, I'm wondering whether you will do a show on this topic to more thoroughly examine this breakdown in communication.
Mm-hmm. Eric Falt, are people taking this to heart and trying to fix it?
Yes, I think that one of the lessons that has emerged very, very quickly from the tsunami is the need for an early warning system. I think that all the governments in the region are aware of this. They're all determined, and right now there's, in fact, a little bit of a fight as to who's going to take the lead. It's obviously very late, but, well, if it avoids another catastrophe in the future, it certainly would be very positive.
And who would pay for it? How would you get it paid? You know, there are a lot of poor people living in a lot of those areas that were hit.
Well, yes and no. I think there's a lot of governments who are very advanced, and we've not talked about a number of governments who have been, and the countries which have been affected by the tsunami. For instance, the Seychelles are rather advanced in their development. The Maldives are also rather advanced, and there are countries like India which are extremely powerful and willing to develop the right systems. They have the a number of scientists who are ready to become involved. Countries like Thailand want to take the lead. Indonesia has been, of course, the hardest hit and is very interested in developing an early warning system. And I think it's just a matter of days before these governments fully agree on the early warning system that they need in the region. There is one in the Pacific. There is really no excuse for not having one now in the Indian Ocean. And I'm sure, by the way, this will have a ripple effect in many, many other countries. Imagine that European countries at this time do not really have an early warning system for tsunamis, whereas the Mediterranean Sea is one of the most prone to tsunamis that you can find in the world. So I think that this is a case where networks are going to be created where they did not exist. I think the caller is right to underline that there's really no excuse for this. But unfortunately, as I'm sure Don and Ellen know, environmental issues do not always get the proper funding that they deserve. And we certainly hope that this is going to change in light of disasters such as this one. Certainly an early warning system is needed, and it will happen in very, very short order. As you know, there's a meeting in Mauritius of small island developing states where most likely the decision will be taken.
All right, Kathleen.
What we really had is, why weren't the communication systems that we have exhausted, you know, via radio? I mean, you have the tsunami warning systems in Washington and in Hawaii. Why weren't all means available now, you know, that we are presently, you know, in working? Okay, they don't have an evacuation plan. Why weren't the means used that we have to communicate to people?
I would guess, and we've talked with some experts, they really were, no one expected this. They were never, like, tested out, you know, the system. People, individuals knew around the world looking at their little screens. But this the system sort of, Don, you want to jump in there?
I agree with the caller, because I think it's unconscionable that, in fact, they picked up the signal of the tsunami within 15 minutes of it,
right,
of it happening. And it was another 2.5 hours before it reached Sri Lanka. A train left Colombo an hour before it hit with 1,200 people. Very few of them survived. It's incredible that, I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but I mean, call the State Department, call the local television station, call your stringers out,
yeah,
wherever they are.
There were people in Japan who saw it. There were people all over the
that's
world.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I cannot understand for the life of me why this was not communicated. I could figure out how to get the information there, and I don't work for these centers. I just can't imagine why they could not figure it out.
All right, Kathleen, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about recovering from the tsunami and the effects on the environment. What about the mangroves? Are they going to be totally washed out? Are they they're under pressure already, Ellen? Or are they coming back? Or
well, they're under tremendous pressure, and as I said before, we've already lost about half the mangrove habitat, if not more, in much of that region. And the pressures are coming primarily from shrimp farming.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the mangroves are cut down in order to make way for shrimp farms. Now, a lot of those would have been inundated by the tsunami as well, and also coastal development, tourism. But there is a capacity to rebuild mangrove habitat if we make a concerted effort to do so. Mm-hmm. Mangroves can be replanted. The habitat can be restored. It wouldn't be difficult from a technological standpoint, but the will has to be there.
Mm-hmm. You know, Eric, there's a World Economic Forum is happening in Davos in a couple of weeks. They're going to talk about that there, or what do you think?
Yes, Yes, obviously this is one of the issues that is going to be debated in Davos. Actually, it's going to be debated in every single major international meeting for the next 3-4 months, if not more. There are many other important meetings coming up, such as the World Disaster Conference, which is going to take place in Kobe, Japan, at the end of January. The tsunami is, of course, going to be discussed there as well. We just hope it's not going to completely derail the discussions at some of these important gatherings. When you talk, for instance, about Mauritius meeting and small island developing states, there's a number of issues that these countries are confronted with, and they need to be discussed just as much as the tsunami. These are very vulnerable islands simply because they have been made more vulnerable by, well, also climate change. I know you were talking about that earlier in your program. These are issues that need to be talked about. The issue of availability of fresh water and why, the issue of waste, which is growing in piles, literally, in some of these low-lying islands, need to be discussed and remedies need to be brought. Again, I don't want to change the topic of the conversation, which is firmly tsunamis, but all international fora in the next few weeks.
But that's an interesting point you make. You know, if you've wrecked the whole infrastructure, why not build it the right way the second time if the tsunami has wrecked it?
I'd like to just elaborate on that just for a second and just say that, you know, I think what we really have to do is look at the other tsunami. And the other tsunami is that, you know, throughout the year of 2004, we saw massive environmental damage. We lost a forest equivalent to the size of Portugal in the world. We saw landslides in the Philippines that killed many people. We saw floods and mudslides in Haiti that killed people because the slopes above where these people live were clear cut of forest. We see increase in the amount of malaria, the amount of dengue because of clearing of forests and standing water and sunlight and the increase in mosquitoes. And it goes on and many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands and millions of people are dying for those causes this year. If we could compress that all into one day, the world would be outraged. The fact that it is spread out over an entire year and slowly happens, it goes unnoticed. And so we had this fantastic tragedy in one day in the world, but I can guarantee you that at least an order or two orders of magnitude more people are killed by the destruction of the environment over the course of the year. And yet it goes largely unnoticed, as Eric was saying, largely underfunded. As Ellen was saying, really predisposes a lot of these places so that when you do have something like a tsunami, that you have even greater damage than you would normally have.
Talking about the environment and face of the tsunami on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. In 1 year, you have more people dying of malaria,
yes,
right, than the whole tsunami.
Absolutely.
If I may intervene just a second, this is Eric again. Yeah, I think that just to follow up on what Don was saying, before the tsunami hit, just a few days before the tsunami hit, UNEP were pointing out that 2004 was, before the tsunami, set to go down in history as the most expensive year for the insurance industry worldwide as a result of natural disasters such as, you know, hurricanes, typhoons, and other weather-related natural disasters. Last year, it cost $16 billion to the insurance industry, and in 2004, before the tsunami, $35 billion. So I think this gives you an order of magnitude of what we are facing.
Yeah, I'd also like to pick up on some of the things that Don had been saying. You know, when you look at the when you look at this whole tragedy, I think if there's any shining light at the end of it, it's that maybe it'll bring home the message that we as humans really are dependent on the environment. It's not a matter of protecting the environment for the environment's sake, but there's a huge connection. And when you look at the survivors, we've heard reports of people who survived the tsunami, included those who clung onto the branches of the mangroves and the trees along the shoreline. You know, those few pieces of habitat that were left were critical to the survival of the people who did, of many of the people who did survive.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Esty.
Hi. I haven't heard yet anyone discussing the issue of chemical, nuclear, and fuel plants that were in the path of the tsunami, storage areas of all these toxic materials. I know that the oceans are already a huge repository of a lot of toxics. What happened in that sense, and just how devastating would that be in the long run?
Eric, you mentioned it briefly before.
Okay.
Yes.
But it's okay. Well, we can talk about it again. Are there any nuclear power plants or spent fuel rods or whatever sitting in pools that might have got washed away?
There is one. It was not washed away, but we don't know the extent of the damage. This is one nuclear power plant which is located in India. There's little information available up until now, but no reason to be overly alarmist. But these are issues that must be studied, and they're very, very high on our list of priorities. Right now we're trying to map out exactly all of these sites, and as I mentioned earlier, contact all of the industries concerned to see if they have anything to report. We're also trying to check through various means, technological means, using remote sensing and GIS systems. It is very important. We have seen that in the Maldives, for instance, one of the key problems that they are encountering is the issue of waste, some of it possibly of chemical or other origin. We do not know at present, but what we know is that in a few locations in the Maldives, and I believe also in the Seychelles, the areas that were used as dumping areas were largely washed out to sea. This in itself is very, very worrisome, and we need to understand it better. To follow up on what Ellen was saying earlier, I think that it's very, very clear that in future we will have to understand the lessons learned from the tsunami disaster as far as the environment is concerned, and to know exactly how sustainable development prior to the event could have prevented or reduced the amount of the damage. I think that it's obvious that in a number of areas there could have been more precautions, and when it comes to industrial sites, be it oil refineries, chemical facilities and the like, it is quite possible that the precautionary measures that should have been taken were not necessarily taken.
We've run out of time, but we will keep following the recovery issue here and the progress being made, and hopefully have you all back to talk about it. My guests have been Ellen Pickich, Executive Director of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science, Eric Fouth, Director of the Division of Communications and Public Information for the United Nations Environment Program, Don Melnick, Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation at Columbia University. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
You're
much.
Welcome. Have a good weekend. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today, as always, from NPR librarians Kim Oleski, Alphonse Vinh. I invite you to surf over to our webpage at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email there on all kinds of links we talk about, and also Science Friday's Kids Connections there, free teaching materials based on Science Friday. You can download and take them into your classroom with you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.